I'm Christopher Leiden for Open Source. This week, we're happy to be featured on the front page of the Stitcher platform for podcasts. Listeners, please add us to your favorites and look out for a new conversation about arts, ideas, and politics every week. Thank you. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. Call it Death Comes to Syria, the First 5 Years. Our guests this hour are unfolding a people's history of a popular uprising and fierce counter-revolution that turned to regional catastrophe in the Middle East, with global side effects still to be revealed. It's also an American story of a government with an imperial disorder, leaning into events in Syria, leaning back, looking away, bluffing, being bluffed, on the way to mass slaughter and now a temporary ceasefire. The five-year story begins in the giddy dawn of the so-called Arab Spring in 2011. Ground-up revolts against autocrats, first in Tunisia, then Egypt, and soon Syria, where the Assad regime, father and son for 40-plus years, struck back with remorseless fury. The Obama White House, having watched the fall of official friends in Tunis and Cairo, was dismayed at the murderous counterforce in Syria, and in August 2011 first spoke the freighted words of regime change.
The transition to democracy in Syria has begun, and it's time for Assad to get out of the way.
We both agree that Assad needs to go.
The world will not waver. Assad must go.
And it is just further evidence that Assad has to go.
A year later, Assad still in charge, President Obama drew a red line against the use of chemical weapons. A year after that, August 2013, on the news of 1,000 deaths, roughly, by poison gas in a liberated suburb of Damascus, President Obama said his red line had been violated.
After careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets.
10 days later, Russia's Vladimir Putin had agreed to transport Assad's chemical weapons out of Syria, and the U.S. strikes were off the table.
This initiative has the potential to remove the threat of chemical weapons without the use of force. I have therefore asked the leaders of Congress to postpone a vote to authorize the use of force while we pursue this diplomatic path.
This month, Obama told The Atlantic magazine he was very proud of his considered restraint in the face of pressures inside and out of his own cabinet to take action. Not the least of the American questions is, do we have a new operating manual for the Middle East, a new strategy, a new psychology? Our guests, Robin Yassin Kassab and Leila Alshami, have written a Syrian narrative of revolution and war titled Burning Country. Hugh Roberts of Tufts brings long experience in his own British-American critique to the table. And then Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia University in New York has a pointed memoir of his efforts with Kofi Annan at the United Nations to strike a peace agreement in Syria 4 years ago. But first, some history. Welcome, Robin Yassin Kassab and Leila Alshami. We want to hear the people's story that we don't hear much, and especially your view of the enemy out there much worse than ISIS, President Assad. You call him and his father arsonists playing firefighters. Give us that view.
What does that mean, an arsonist playing at being a firefighter? Well, Assad, for example, at the moment everybody's saying the greater evil is ISIS, the mad jihadists who want to kill us in Paris and London and probably Boston and so on. We would argue that the greater evil in Syria is President Assad. He's responsible for, 95 to 97% of the civilian casualties. Mm. Until recently, he's been the only force there with an air force. The vast majority of civilian casualties have come from the air force. He's responsible for the vast majority of people displaced. 70% of refugees in Europe say they're escaping Assad. And then the rest say they're escaping ISIS or Nusra or other militias, the PYD, etc. The other point is that, you know, the problem is that Syria has changed from being what started as a peaceful protest movement. It became militarized. It turned into a war. Every state in the world jumped in and started interfering in that situation. And it became a sectarian war, and it started feeding into the larger regional dysfunction, the Sunni-Shia issues between Saudi Arabia and Iran, all the problems left by Saddam Hussein's sectarianism and then by the disastrous American invasion and occupation of Iraq. So people think, well, look how dangerous this region is. Look how sectarian this is. Look at all the terrorism and mad jihadism coming out of there. We have to work with the dictator for the sake of stability. This guy is wearing a tie. He doesn't have a beard. So even if he's killed 97% of the people, we should work with him. But Assad has deliberately started this war. He's deliberately made the thing militarized, and he deliberately made it sectarian.
Explain that transition from a democratic resistance that became militarized, that became jihadized, that became Islamized. Who contrived that story? Who contrived the reality on the ground?
Well, for a start, it hasn't become completely jihadized or Islamized. That's been overdone. It's been dramatically overdone in a rather orientalist way by commentators of left as much as right, because there are still all of these democratic councils on the ground, self-organized communities, free army militias, which a lot of journalists claim don't exist but clearly do. So that's not the whole story. But how did it happen? Well, Assad deliberately provoked a war because he knew that he couldn't survive a genuine reform process, that one thing would lead to another, and he and his cohort would end up at best in prison and stripped of their wealth. So as they wrote on the walls, Assad or we burn the country, they decided to burn the country because the people didn't want Assad. They did this because it's worked before. In the late 70s, there was a movement of Islamists, nationalists, leftists, communists against Assad. Not a massive popular movement like 2011, but a movement nevertheless. It was so ruthlessly suppressed that by 1982, all that was left of that movement was the armed wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, which then, out of idiocy or desperation, staged an armed uprising in the city of Hama, at which point the Assad regime said, great, they've brought guns out, it's a war situation. They went in and flattened the historical center of that ancient city and killed somewhere between 10 and 40,000 people, we don't know how many. And that kept Syrians terrified and silent for the next decades until 2011. It worked then. The Algerians did something similar in 91, 92. And are still there. That regime is still in power. The Russians did it in Chechnya 1 to Chechnya 2. If you study that, you see the same thing. Assad, at the same time that he was locking up and torturing to death tens of thousands of peaceful, non-violent, non-sectarian protesters, he was also releasing Salafist jihadists from prison. And a lot of these people went off and founded these organizations, Jaish al-Islam, Ahrar al-Sham, and even worse, went off to join the upper ranks of the Islamic State, Jabhat al-Nusra, the Al-Qaeda franchise, and so on. He did this deliberately. He organized a string of sectarian massacres in the summer of 2012 on the central plain between Homs and Hama because he wanted a sectarian backlash in order to terrify two constituencies. Firstly, minorities in Syria, religious minorities, bourgeois secularists in Syria who may have sympathized with the democratic aims of the revolution, but when they saw angry Sunni Muslims threatening vengeance, as you do after massacres and children being tortured to death and a mass rape campaign, they suddenly thought, well, if the alternative to this guy is people who may kill us just because of who we are, just because we're not Muslims in the way they are, then we have no choice but to stick to this guy. And secondly, the West. He's done it very effectively. He's convinced people who don't know much about Syria or don't want to know much about Syria in the West that, yes, this guy is the lesser evil. But he's actually the source of the problem, him and his backers.
Leila Al-Shami, let Robin catch his breath here. What's your version of these things? And very specifically, this thought that he learned, Bashar al-Assad learned from his father, you can win a war, you will never win a negotiation. So wipe them out on the Homs model. But tell us about the people.
Well, I think that's very true. I think we need to remember that when the protest movement first started, people were not calling for the fall of the regime, unlike in Tunisia and Egypt. People were calling for reform. They were chanting slogans such as the Syrian people will not be humiliated, the Syrian people will not be insulted. But due to the massive repression which the state unleashed upon peaceful protesters, people radicalised. And over time, they started calling for the fall of the regime, and in time we got calls for the execution of the president. But yes, I agree with Robin, the Assad regime really provoked a war and provoked sectarianism within this conflict. There was a string of massacres carried out against Sunni communities, often by solely Alawi militias, to frighten, to cause tension between different communities within Syria. And as the violence increased from the state, of course, people took up arms to defend themselves, to defend their communities from the assault of the state. And in that sense, you get this increasing militarisation within the conflict. And then, as Robin said, because of the provocations against certain communities, specifically targeting Sunni communities, and also through releasing lots of Islamists from jail, you get an increasing sectarian of the conflict as well. But I think the important thing is not to see this solely through a military lens and not to see this solely through a sectarian lens, because what's missing from the debate about Syria is what people have been doing on the ground in the most...
And what are they doing today?
Well, since the revolution started, I mean, what you need to understand first of all about Syria is that it's an ultra-authoritarian regime where there was no political pluralism. There was no independent active civil society in Syria prior to the revolution. Since the revolution started, you've had an explosion in civil activism. For example, you have many groups that are working on recording human rights violations, talking about issues of democracy. You have organisations which are working to provide relief. And also one of the most interesting things is the way in which communities are self-organising to manage the basic necessities of life as the regime has withdrawn from those areas.
Hold it there. We'll be back. We're talking about the wasting of Syria. I'm thinking of the last tragic line in your book, Burning Country. A people who dared to demand freedom received annihilation instead. Coming up, the regime change reflex in American policy and how Barack Obama adapted it. Hugh Roberts and Jeff Sachs join us next. This is Open Source. Syria was in ruins a year ago when our guest Hugh Roberts wrote a remarkable long piece about it in the London Review of Books. The death toll was then 200,000. It may have doubled since then. Now professor at Tufts University, Hugh Roberts has spent a lifetime studying and writing about North Africa and the Middle East. You hear this plea from the ground up. What was that Syrian democracy and those Syrian people entitled to from the rest of us when it got awful in the Assad reaction?
I'm afraid a rather pessimistic realist. I entirely accept that what initially oriented the protests was very much the same outlook as was manifested in Tunisia and in Egypt, a demand for dignity, a protest against authoritarian, arbitrary misrule. In other words, a complex of sentiments that we can all identify with and sympathize with and which could have developed, given the right conditions, into a sustained democratic movement, as happened in Tunisia. The problem is that Syria wasn't Tunisia. Important conditions...
Egypt wasn't either. Yeah.
And Egypt wasn't either. That's one point. The second point, however, is that I've long been convinced that democracy is not something that the West can bestow on any of these countries. The peoples of these countries have to work out how to get it for themselves. They have to struggle for it. That's not a simple struggle. It's not something that that can happen overnight and so on. I think that in the Syrian case, the conditions were particularly difficult from that point of view. Syria is, in a way, the heart of the Arab world. It's the heart of the Levant. Unfortunately, it's of enormous geopolitical significance. I think that it was always very unlikely that the conflict within Syria would remain insulated from wider regional calculations and tensions. And so we see, all, as Robin said, all kinds of other states diving into this
situation. And how remarkable, therefore, that today there are over 400 democratically elected councils working. So despite the fact of Russian imperialism, Iranian imperialism, American imperialism too, Saudi imperialism, despite all of these states jumping in, despite the fact that the Syrian people are under attack from their own state and internationally and from transnational jihadists, both Sunni and Shia, they have remarkably achieved over 400 democratically elected councils.
Yes, I mean, I agree that democracy is not something that can be brought by the West. They tried that in the last decade to bring democracy to the Arab people on the back of American tanks, and obviously it failed. But what people are failing to see today is that it doesn't need the West to bring democracy. Arab people, Syrian people are practicing democracy in the most difficult of circumstances, and that's something that's really missing from the narrative on Syria.
It's something that people don't talk about. It's something that if you ask people in the street what's happening in Syria, they know about ISIS cutting heads off. They know about all the states and the geopolitics and the supposed Sunni-Shia conflict, although actually Shia people in Syria are 1% of the population, so that's not really what it's about. But they don't know about this miracle. It was supposedly so important to the West that the Arabs have democracy a decade ago that they invaded and occupied a country and created a whole load of problems. And today we don't even bother talking about it because we're wrapped up in geopolitical nonsense, preconceived grand narratives, and we don't bother talking to the people on the ground.
Perhaps I could suggest, if in fact I'm not going to be allowed to complete my answer to your question, that we actually...
No, do. Go ahead.
Well, I think the point is I understand why Robin and Lila don't really want us to spend more time discussing the geopolitics. It is an old debate.
It's all we discuss, but go on.
And the point here is, my view is that part of the problem, I'd like us to get back to what they've been talking about, actually, because I think it's very interesting, and I have a question I'd like to put to them. But just to finish your concern about Western policy, it seems to me that a general feature of the so-called Arab Spring has been the concern of the Western powers to actually have a hand in events. They have been absolutely refused to, following the Tunisian story, which they misread and didn't have a piece of. They've wanted to have a controlling interest in what happens elsewhere. And this has been characterized and manifested in statements by the US that deciding who has to go and so on and so forth. Also the French deciding who's legitimate and isn't and so on in Libya. This has been a constant theme, and it has been a factor that has been perverting things in these various countries. And I think that in the case of US policy, and I would associate British government with US policy, on Syria, they clearly misread the Syrian situation, thinking that when President Obama said Assad must go back in 2011, they assumed he would go fairly soon, as Gaddafi went fairly soon, as Mubarak went fairly soon. They were completely incapable.
But your question,
let me just finish. They were completely incapable of seeing how different Syria was from these other countries, and that's actually quite a condemnation of them for incompetence. But I'd like to, if I may, take up the challenge from Robin and Leila, given their, I think, welcome insistence on the importance of the activities of the Syrian people in this drama. And I sympathize with their view that that's been lost sight of. There are two issues here, it seems to me. Clearly there's been a problem about enabling the Syrian people, or the Syrian people themselves acquiring the capacity to develop a unified opposition movement that is building on the local democratic activism that has actually been there and that they are drawing our attention to. I'd like to ask, looking ahead, how they see that actually managing to be developed at the national level, beyond the local level. Your argument is, and I'm sympathetic to it, that there is this kind of, at ground level, there's a foundation of civil society activism, of community activism. How can that be built on, given the context
that is that Syria has become a cockpit for all these other external forces. My own view is that what Western policy, if it's going to be of any use at all, as opposed to a nuisance, to put it mildly, is it should seek to drain the Syrian cockpit of these external players, get them to back off, absolutely, find a way of enabling the Syrians to resume ownership of their own.
It's a lot of players. You're talking Saudis, Russians, us.
I completely agree with you. I completely and totally agree with you. I think there's this misconception that if you look beyond American statements and Western statements and rhetoric to actual actions, the Americans in the Syrian case actually have been on the side of counter-revolution. It seems that Obama has actually decided to hand over the Syria file, as we heard at the beginning when he made a red line for supposedly for chemical weapons, and then when he didn't mean it, and then when it happened, he handed it over to Russia. He said, "I don't want this Middle Eastern cake anymore. I'll hand it over to other versions of imperialism." Unfortunately, after 2011, it's a very messy process. Revolution is wrapped up with all forms of counter-revolution. The people themselves, however, started asking for a say in how their countries were governed. This makes it complicated for all regimes, because it's much easier to have one guy that you can tap on the head or bribe or threaten and get what you want than to have a complex society full of different actors who you have to deal with. But I think the first part of an answer to your question is to stop the horrific violence, because these democratic councils, self-organized committees that we're talking about, at the moment they are keeping life together in these horrifically bombed and traumatized and tormented areas. The reason why there's any life surviving, why there's any rubbish collection or food distribution or education or healthcare at all, is because of these local councils. All they're able to do is focus on day-to-day survival. If you could really stop the bombing, if the United States does want to get involved, I think the best way it could get involved would be to pressure other states to get out. And that includes the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, and the most violent and the most committed, the Russian imperialists and the Iranian occupation troops.
Hold it there for a moment, Robin. Another little bit of history and a sermon from our friend, the economist Jeffrey Sachs, the global poverty fighter at Columbia University, and the right hand on development issues of the UN Secretary General. He was at Kofi Annan's side through the effort to broker a UN ceasefire and peace process in Syria 4 years ago. He told me in some detail this week what he learned in that effort.
Well, my belief is that this war could have been stopped back in 2012, and it was the United States that prevented the end of the war at that point.
Really?
For a reason, Chris, that actually the U.S. has explained, but I think it is not only an insufficient reason, I think it is a horribly misguided approach, actually. Basically, the U.S. from the start of the Arab Spring thought that this was the opportunity to overthrow the Assad regime. I have no great sympathy at all, to say the least, for the Assad regime. But the idea that the Arab Spring was an occasion for U.S. Operations together with its allies, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, to overthrow that government, or similarly, the occasion for the United States with its allies, Britain and France, to overthrow Gaddafi, was extraordinarily misguided and arrogant, and in my view, is what has created this bloodbath, actually. Now, in 2012, Kofi Annan had Russia and the other members of the Security Council basically saying, okay, let's move to a ceasefire. But the United States said, well, no, not until Assad goes.
Jeff, the Kofi Annan plan, as you're describing it in 2012, sounds a lot like the John Kerry-assisted ceasefire that we've got today. Russians in on the talks and Assad will stay in power, at least for a while. I mean, 4 years produced maybe nothing but a huge, huge list of dead and wounded and refugees.
4 years produced 10 million displaced people, hundreds of thousands dead, massive destruction of the Syrian landscape, infrastructure, and historic sites and archaeological sites that somehow had survived 2,000 years of history, and it's in our watch that it's being destroyed. And I find it absolutely horrendous and haven't felt for one day since early 2011 that we were on the right track. What is being negotiated right now was in hand 4 years ago, but the U.S. turned it down.
Jeff, on the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton said that she had negotiated that agreement in 2012, setting forth a ceasefire, moving toward a political resolution in Syria before the bloodbath. You heard it with educated ears. What do you remember about how she told Kofi Annan, no, Assad's got to go first? And what was the rationalization for it now? And how does it look in hindsight now that Assad's going to stay for a while and we do have a ceasefire?
There's no doubt that the U.S. blocked actions in mid-2012. And they blocked actions for reasons that were actually public at the time, deeply misguided in my view, but public at the time. By the way, even to a temporary period of transition, the U.S. was absolutely insistent and resolute, he must go now. So even on its face, if the goal was to remove Assad, the U.S. position, in my mind, was extraordinarily naive and misconceived from a diplomatic process point of view. To give a digression, if I might, I was very much involved in the Polish transition from communism in 1989.
Don't I remember?
And one of the signal moments of the success of that peaceful transition was actually that the Solidarity Movement said that the communist president could stay. Jaruzelski should stay for a couple of years. And they made a transition compromise where the Democratic Movement would take the domestic ministries and the communist outgoing regime, as it were, would keep the so-called power ministries. And that was a two-year transition, and Lech Walesa then became president after that. And that's how you make a transition like this. And in 2012, the quality of the U.S. diplomacy was shockingly bad. I think, per se, making the demands that in such a clear, unequivocal way the U.S. was demanding regime change was bound to fail anyway, because what it meant was that there was no way to get a Security Council resolution. Assad and Syria are a Russian ally. They're allowed to have allies, by the way.
Jeff, even at the time, it seems strange that the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, were not picking up the cue from Putin and Russia, that their veto through the UN was lifted and they would be part of a solution in Syria. And after all, they are the government's main backer, their main international backer. And that's where events led in the end, toward Putin's military engagement and then his place at the table and the ceasefire.
The whole story is amazing. And we're really like in Plato's cave watching the shadows, because so much of this is hidden from view. And we have to make certain surmises. Here's my surmise.
Okay.
My surmise is that the U.S. deep state, as it's called, that means the CIA and a lot of long-term military planning, has had the view for essentially a quarter century now since the demise of the Soviet Union that we should take territory and establish new bases and get Russia out of the Middle East. And we have allies, our longstanding ally, which is as problematic as it gets, Saudi Arabia, which has another interest. It's not so much anti-Soviet as anti-Iranian. So we're pulled into the Sunni-Shia divide at the same time. And from the U.S. point of view, opposing Russia is the story, because while it's hard for me to understand at all, and I think should be hard for all of us to understand, there is part of the U.S. mindset that is absolutely still playing the Cold War game, as if they didn't hear that the Cold War ended a quarter century ago. Now, my interpretation is that Obama is deeply uneasy about this. You read the Atlantic Monthly, you watch his actions. He knows this is not right. And he explains in the Atlantic Monthly that really the job of the president is to hold back this war machine. The problem with President Obama, though, is first, that's a hard job. When the CIA and your Secretary of State and at least a part of the military establishment is telling you, go, go, go. It takes a lot of stamina for the president to hold all of that back. And President Obama's problem has been that he's a vacillator and he lets himself be overruled, which is what happened in Libya. He knew this was the wrong thing. His defense secretary at the time actually said, Mr. President, we already have two wars. Do we really need a third war?
Yeah, Robert Gates, right?
But exactly, Robert Gates. But Hillary won that. And where I really fault Obama in that case is his weakness in letting himself be pushed there. The only place, but it's a great achievement, I have to say, that he did not allow himself to be pushed in that manner was in the Iran nuclear deal, where he stood his ground against almost every instinct of the security establishment and the Congress. But when it came to Syria and when it came to Libya, he basically allowed things to happen. But Hillary, for many, many reasons, has always been on the side of the war party in this. And President Obama, most of the time, let the war party have its way in a limited way, not fully, but at least in a limited way. And hence, we have this kind of bloodbath that was absolutely avoidable. I don't have a solution to how you don't have a war and you have Assad go. My solution is you recognize that overthrowing other countries' dictators is a pretty failed and thankless approach that has failed vastly more than it's ever succeeded for American foreign policy.
That was Jeff Sachs at Columbia University. Coming up, a full century into the Sykes-Picot imperialist map of the Middle East, the case and the chance for redrawing it. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. With the Middle East hand, Hugh Roberts from Tufts, and the authors Robin Yassin Kassab and Leila Alshami, with a book about their Syria called Burning Country. We're listening for history and lessons from the ground up. First, on this matter of Assad must go or not, 2012, now, how important?
I must say, look, this is a whole misconception. There's very, very, very few Syrians that are asking outside powers to come and remove. It's true that the coalition, the elite based outside, has put its eggs in the basket, foolishly, of the outside, of states outside coming in and removing Assad for them. That's a massive misconception. The states of the world don't want democracy in the Middle East. They don't want the dictators to go. And that's why actually this, I mean, yes, I mean, I don't understand what Sachs was saying about how supposedly Obama's letting the war party get its way partially. What the Free Army got a few ready meals, so therefore the war party has got its way. At the same time, Russia is supplying the guy with attack helicopters and tanks and so on. Iran is providing tens of thousands of on-the-ground troops and organizing transnational jihadists on the front line, which is making the ISIS problem and the Sunni identity politics so much worse. It seems strange to me that the most significant act of the Obama administration militarily has been to veto other powers from sending the anti-aircraft weapons which the civilian communities so desperately need
which
to defend
countries?
Themselves. Well, the Saudis and the Turks and the Qataris have said that they want to give anti-aircraft weapons, of course, for their own filthy reasons, to do with their own geostrategic chess game. They don't want democracy either, but they, in part responding to public pressure in their own countries, they want to give anti-aircraft weapons to the resistance, and the Americans have vetoed that. The Americans have done a deal with Iran over the sanction, the nuclear sanctions. I don't think there should have been sanctions on Iran in the first place over the nuclear issue, but they're doing a deal and going to do business with Iran precisely at the first moment in 300 years that Iran takes a really aggressive sectarian and expansionist turn and has it has Shia militias and occupation troops in both Syria and Iraq. This is a major source of ISIS. This is a major cause for the Sunni Islamist backlash.
So you don't welcome the Putin hand at all, Robin, and I want to get
Well, of course I don't. I mean, Putin went in there with his direct intervention. Of course, he's been intervening militarily, politically, and economically since the start. And he's the main sponsor of this terrible dictatorship. But his since last September, his direct military intervention started. He said that he was going in to take out ISIS, to rescue Palmyra and all the rest of it. Well, 80% of his bombs fell on democratic nationalist communities. Not even on the militias defending those communities, but usually on bakeries, schools, and hospitals.
And on what logic?
If you think, on what logic? On the logic that he wants to do what Assad has been trying to do, to destroy the democratic nationalist opposition, so the world is presented with a choice between the fascist dictator and the mad jihadist, assuming that the world will choose the fascist dictator because he wears a tie and doesn't have a beard. It's appalling. If you think that the answer, the political answer, is to bomb the hell out of democratic nationalist civilian communities, their bakeries, their schools, and their hospitals, then you might see some logic in inviting this savage imperial assault on Assad. I mean, here's the problem with the so-called left. It seems to think that, you know, American imperialism is bad, which of course it is, but that Russian imperialism is somehow good. You know, Russian imperialism is filthy. It's disgusting. It's grotesque. It's murderous. But there's lifting, no excuse for it.
Lifting the Russian veto on talks looked, I have to say it to me, and I expect to you like a good thing.
So lifting the Russian veto on
talks on a peace negotiation.
Well, I'm not sure there was a Russian veto on talks. It seems to me the logic of what has happened is that the U.S., while refusing, of course, and this was predictable from the beginning, to commit ground troops, has wanted to play a larger role in determining the outcome in Syria than its own commitment of resources would actually make possible. In other words, it's overplayed its hand. But in doing that, and here I very much agree with Jeffrey Sachs, it prevented any possibility of a political resolution years ago. And it seems to me it was a great mistake for Obama to say Assad has to step down, as he did in 2011. And it was a second great mistake made by the Americans was when Russia came to their rescue in 2013 over the chemical weapons thing and enabled Obama to step back from his own verbal commitment to striking Syria because of the chemical weapons. That was a moment where it should have been possible. It was an opportunity wasted. For the two countries to come to an agreement as to what should happen, and they didn't do that.
An imperialist agreement.
Robin, I entirely agree with you. You can call it imperialist. You're not wrong. The problem is the world, unfortunately, is structured in that way. And if we are on the same page about...
And the Arab people trying to break out of that filthy model. They're trying to have a say in their own lives, and you're saying, no, these filthy imperialist powers should make
all
a deal between themselves. And what you're doing is, as you do in your articles in the London Review, of books is completely and totally ignoring what happens on the ground. The Kofi Annan plan in 2012 had absolutely no chance whatsoever of working, not because of America, not because of Russia, but because of the actors on the ground. Because the Syrian people could not stand to see the mass rape campaign, the mass torture campaign, and the destruction of their cities, and because the Assad regime had absolutely no intention of compromise or of going. That's the fundamental reality. You need some local possibility of peace before foreign imperialist powers can come and put the seal on it.
Hugh Roberts, please.
Well, I don't caricature other people's views, and I don't like it when my views are caricatured.
I'm caricaturing yours. Do you remember what Hisham Mutter, the great Libyan novelist,
said? Are you going to allow me my say,
okay,
Robin?
Yeah,
Robin,
it's his turn, please.
Thank you. The fact of the matter is, and this is just a bitter reality, that the Middle East has always been a region in which the great powers of the earth have confronted each other and maneuvered. That's something I regret every bit as much as you. But it's reality. And the question is, does one's discourse address reality or pretend that reality is other than what it is? I have wanted the violence to stop, and I've considered that stopping the violence, like you said a little while ago, should be the priority. And I've been appalled at the way The various powers have connived at perpetuating the violence all these years. I was proposing a formula for ending the violence 3 years ago. How many hundreds of thousands of people have died since then?
But how was that?
Let me finish. Hang on. The point is that in order for a democratic potential that you insist, and I'd like to agree with you, has been there, to realize itself, the violence must stop. That is absolutely elementary. How it stopped is a secondary consideration. If it stopped through some sort of agreement between the external players, so much the better. My view is that you cannot expect the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris to pull back from fishing in these waters and adding fuel to the fire unless the bigger powers address the tensions between those various players and find a way of addressing those concerns. I've been arguing for 3 years that there needs to be a regional approach to the tensions in the region in order to drain the Syrian cockpit of these outside players. I had hoped that you and I could actually agree on that so that what you look forward to, namely the self-realization of the Syrian people along a democratic line of development, could at last become possible.
I want to ask Leila a question. From the heart of an American peacenik, with this reservation about any American small or large gestures of support for the revolution in Syria, including, you know, no-fly zones or this kind of thing, without boots on the ground, etc., it seems to me easily imaginable that the democratic forces would be so ground up by the Assad machine, merciless as it is, that one thing would lead to another. We would be impelled morally and otherwise to extend our protection. And then the slippery slope, it could have been worse, it seems to me, than the absolutely disastrous war in Iraq in terms of escalation of our commitment. And I guess I'm looking for your view of after the disasters in Iraq and Libya and Afghanistan, can you understand the reservation of American citizens to do anything in that zone anymore?
Well, I completely agree with that reservation. I think America should stay out of Syria. I'm against all interventions from foreign powers in Syria. But I think also that there's really a tendency to overstate America's influence in Syria at the moment. And I think this comes from a basic misunderstanding of how the region has changed since 2011. Yes, of course, when you have a popular struggle, a revolution, you have every state in the world trying to intervene in terms of influencing that process and trying to control that process and get power in that situation. Let's be very clear that no state is intervening to support the popular struggle. They're intervening for their own interests. Sure. But as far as I'm concerned, yes, America is involved. It's trying very much to control the negotiations. It's trying to influence the SNC and the external coalition. And it's also intervening in terms of bombing ISIS. But I think that people have a tendency to really overstate what America's role is now, because the main imperialisms in Syria at this time is Russian and Iranian imperialism. And America really has played a marginal role, has been scrambling for influence and really failing since 2011 to assert its influence in Syria.
I'll ask you all, have we made enough of the ISIS connections? It's striking in the presidential campaigns, both parties, all the debates. Nobody has anything at all to say about Syria, and everybody wants to say ISIS is the issue. We're going to bomb the bejesus out of it. We're going to make it glow in the dark. What is the considered view, is the one, about the paternity of ISIS? You track it partly to sort of American Pentagon fantasies of something that would help us undermine Assad. You say Assad designed it as the foil for his own depravity,
yeah,
et cetera. But I mean, where does the ISIS question come up?
Could I suggest that first of all, that it is being put front page center by Western politicians because it's an easy target. They prefer to have something to talk about that they can demonize and that they can say, this is the problem, and off we go, bombs away. And I think that is
a kind of evading the real issue. It's dealing with an easy issue.
Ignoring our own paternity with ISIS. They're
well, you can't expect them to talk about their own paternity. It's well, a complicated
why not?
Question.
I mean,
well,
they're
because
they're
it's complicated. It's complicated. Of course, Robin is right. Assad has in part connived at the emergence of this dreadful thing, because this is what the Algerians did. They connived at the emergence of a horrific Islamist group called the GIA. It suited them to have a savage enemy. But at the same time, there was American involvement, and clearly ISIS originally comes out of the terrible situation in Iraq. There's no doubt about it. Its leadership is Iraqi.
The Sunni officers who had no place to go after we occupied the country.
So the paternity is complex, but let's not get too bogged down in that. I think the point is it is being used as a way of evading the other much more difficult issues. And it's symptomatic of the extent to which both of these countries, Syria and Iraq, have been induced to become failed states. Now, this is my own view is that Western policy should not be, I certainly don't support a policy that tears up Sykes-Picot. I believe in a policy that enables both of these countries to recover their territorial integrity. And by the way, I think that if Robin and Leila are right in insisting on the existence of a self-conscious and Syrian people, the Syrian people will not abide the breakup and division of Syria.
It's Robin's turn.
Okay.
I would agree, absolutely. And I think that that's one thing that the vast majority of Syrians, you know, pro-revolution and pro-regime or anti-revolution more often, or scared of the revolution, the one thing they can agree on, apart from some Kurds, is that they don't want partitions. And at the moment, with this imperial carve-up that seems to be being discussed behind closed doors, behind all these powers, it looks like we may be moving towards that. Some kind of federalism or decentralization probably is part of the solution in Syria when we've got these, after years of war, we've got these explosive polarizations. But Sykes-Picot, of course, there's nothing sacred about those borders which were drawn by foreign imperialists and then it was followed by sectarian engineering, which worked out very badly indeed. There's nothing sacred, but if we're going to get rid of the Sykes-Picot borders, we want something better. We want something that doesn't divide people more on sect. And what it looks like is that, you know, Syrians are already upset that Greater Syria was chopped up into little bits and each one given to a different sect or a different sphere of influence, different imperial control. They're angry about that. They don't want what's left of Syria to be carved up into more pieces, which will then be at war with each other, which will then lead to a great sectarian cleansing. It doesn't work out because everyone's mixed up. There are Alawis, not just on the coast, but in Damascus. There are Sunnis on the coast. There are Christians in the east, etc.
Robin, bring it to the moment, and Leila too. As you write in the book, Syria is now entirely owned by outsiders on all sides. Saudi money, CIA weaponry, Hezbollah fighters, Iran, Russia. I mean, it's been chopped up already. And you say if the Democratic opposition made an assault on Damascus that get ground up, but neither will Damascus ever reclaim, claw back the parts of the country it's lost. What's next? Where does it go from here? Where would you?
Well, I mean,
where do the Democrats go? I guess
as you have worked out, I disagree with you on most things, but I think where we agree is that if there was a permanent dramatic reduction in the violence, if you could stop everybody bombing fundamentally, then things could start moving again. What you've seen recently, it's not a ceasefire because the death count has gone down from about 120 a few weeks ago to about 40 a day now, which is a lot better. It's still awful. But with that, you suddenly see the revival of civil protest. You see women back on the streets. You see the Free Army flags rather than the black flags of the Islamist battalions. You see people in Idlib province fighting against and protesting against Nusra, the Al-Qaeda franchise. As soon as there's a breathing space for the people, then the civil activism becomes very visible again. And you don't need the Free Army to defeat Damascus, to move into central Damascus and destroy the Alawi enclaves around there and the military bases around there. You don't need them to storm the coast. What you need is a calming of the violence, and then there's the possibility of a good example. in the liberated areas. And when people in places which are controlled by the regime see that good example, they will be less scared of the jihadist movements and so on, and there will be much more possibilities for people to come together, communicate, and that would be a dramatic movement against the regime. That's why the regime wants war, because as soon as the war stops, the regime will be truly challenged again.
A last word, Leila, maybe for the women.
Well, yes, I mean, one thing that we have seen is women back on the streets, and I think that's very positive because women have long argued that one of the main reasons that they're not going on the streets is security issues. But I agree that an end to the bombing will allow civil activism to resume, and it gives these groups less rationale, these groups such as the extremist groups, less rationale when there's no military conflict.
Thank you, Leila Alshami. Thank you, Robin Yassin Kassab. Thank you, Hugh Roberts. Thanks to Jeff Sachs, too. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. وتخرج لا شيء من الإنسانية فيك سوى الصمت وتسأل أين الله؟